tattoo on your ankle. Oh, I thought that was new. I'd seen it before.
I know.
Okay. What happens when you grow up in Bolivia? What?
We're very close very early growing up in Bolivia.
Well, that's why you have no front teeth. Just a bridge. I'm gonna just tell them to start. Beth has no front teeth because she was dropped when she was about 15 and fell down the Guachaya steps. Oh, okay, she still fell down and knocked all of her teeth out. What? I won't.
Did you learn your lesson?
No.
I did. If you didn't fall down any more steps, then you certainly did not stop behaving badly. What?
Hello, welcome. I'm Steve Borges. I'm the director of the Center for Latin American Studies at the University of Chicago. And I welcome you to the Latin American briefing on the future of South America, wrestling ideologies, and regional stabilities. Now, this briefing is sponsored by the Center for Latin American Studies and the Global Voices Program of the International Council. Our guest this evening is Mr. Gonzalo Sanchez Machado, graduate of the University of Chicago. Under seats, as you come in, is a packet that includes a biography of Mr. Sanchez-Rosado, the text of his letter of resignation as president, and an op-ed article that he published in the Washington Post following his resignation. I hope you'll find these materials helpful, and I would like to apologize for the very abbreviated and reductive characterization on the poster for this event, very complex events that led to Mr. Sanchez's resignation. He's had a long and very distinguished career as a statesman in Bolivia, including leadership in the legislature to combat the hyperinflation of the 1980s, service in cabinet ministries, leadership in his political party, the Movimiento Nacionalista Revolucionario, the MNR, and two presidencies, the first from 1993 to 1997, the second from 2002 to 2003. Now the format this evening, as in our other Latin American briefings, will be a talk, and then, as is the tradition of the University of Chicago, questions afterwards. You're all welcome to ask questions, and of course, you're invited to a reception afterwards in the room adjoining this one. Mr. Alan Kalata, Newcomb Family Distinguished Service Professor of Anthropology, will introduce Sanchez Lozada and moderate the discussion as it is.
But let me add my warm welcome to this evening's event, the continuation of this important Latin American briefing series sponsored by the Center for Latin American Studies here at the University of Chicago and the International House, which, thank goodness, has been saved from the hands of the university, which attempted to change this into a dormitory, a business school at one point. I'm glad it stands here as a monument to international engagements. An editorial comment about that any longer. But this event holds particular significance for those of us here who are citizens of Bolivia, those of us who have lived and worked in Bolivia for many years, those of us who have family and close friends currently in the country, and those of us who have come to know and to love Bolivia and its people deeply. Now, the political events, the economic vicissitudes, and social conflicts that have affected Bolivia over the course of the past years in particular should be of concern to all of us, whether we are intimately familiar with Bolivia or not. All citizens concerned about hemispheric issues of political stability, representative government, economic development, and social justice should contemplate the current situation in Bolivia with great trepidation. The implications of recent political and social developments in Bolivia reach far beyond its territorial boundaries. The national social contract in Bolivia, always in continuous flux and renegotiation, now seems instead on the verge of dissolving altogether into a bitterly contested political factions and gross regional disparities. The very concept of a national, multi-ethnic, and plurilinguistic society bound by principles of democracy and representative government that are enshrined in Bolivia's constitution appears today under grave threat. The sentiments of secession and the pressures for autonomy by regional and ethnic coalitions seems no longer to be strategic political rhetoric alone, but presents us with the real possibility that Bolivia, as a nation, could, de facto, if not de jure, fragment into autonomous and intractably opposed political, economic, and social regions, a development that would surely destabilize the region and contribute to an even greater impoverishment and alienation of Bolivia's majority indigenous populations. But it's my hope tonight that we will not focus alone on analyzing the root causes of this disturbingly apocalyptic vision of Bolivia's future. Rather, I hope we can consider the conditions of economic, social, and political possibility that will permit Bolivia to overcome this scenario of enduring bitter societal fragmentation. As you're all aware, our guest tonight, former President Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada, has been at the epicenter of Bolivian politics for over 20 years. From 1985 to 1988, Mr. Sánchez de Lozada served as President of the Senate and Minister of Planning and Coordination in the administration of President Victor Paz Estenssoro, and confronted the hyperinflation that then was ravaging Bolivia's economy through a program that has come to be known as shock therapy. And those of us who lived and worked and paid salaries in Bolivia in that period know exactly what hyperinflation was doing to the country and know that the importance of that particular move to bring control to that economic chaos. Subsequently, as president of Bolivia from 1993 to 1997, President Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada initiated a series of economic and social reforms, the so-called Plan de Todos, intended to stimulate the economy and articulate comprehensive plans for sustainable development. During his second term as president that began in 2002, his government sought ways to continue and deepen those reforms, but the events of 2003, which we are all likely very familiar, truncated his attempts, and Mr. Sánchez de Lozada stepped down in the face of social protest, and his vice president, Carlos Mesa, assumed the office of the presidency. The bare bones of political biography don't tell much about the complicated and difficult situation Bolivia and the region finds itself in at the moment. Ongoing debates about globalization versus indigenous autonomy, the idea of fragmentation are all on the agenda in very surprising and disturbing ways in Bolivia. Tonight again, I hope we'll certainly get a perspective from one of the central players in this long debate. And then again, as Professor Borges mentioned, this is the University of Chicago, and we expect and hope for a vigorous question and answer and debate period afterwards. With that, I would invite former President Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada to make a presentation, approximately a half hour.
Being a politician, I cannot promise to be brief. But I would like to ask you to, if I get carried away and I don't keep the microphone in front of me, just raise your hand and I'll know that you're not hearing me. I want to thank the Center for Latin American Affairs for having invited me and insisting that I come. It's a great pleasure. I study at the University of Chicago many years and many kilos behind. And I remember it fondly as one of the formative experiences I had. I hope it's a great school here because my granddaughter's here. My children wouldn't even visit the place when I suggested it because, of course, children have to cut the umbilical cord. But my grandchildren don't feel that obligation, and she's here enjoying it and doing well. The only thing I can say is that this opportunity is very important for me, and I hope that when we get to questions and answers, it won't be only the questions that will be debate, it will be opinions, and that we can have a discussion. That's the most useful thing in an event of this nature. I think it's important to give you a little bit of background of who I am and what I believe in. First of all, I came here to the United States in 1975 1996 when I was 1 year old. I was the oldest son of a Bolivian diplomat, first secretary of the then Bolivian legation. When I was five, he was exiled by a military coup. He wrote a very nasty resignation letter and was invited not to return. But I had returned to Bolivia, where I lived with my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, and with my mother and brothers and sisters. And I went to school, the first year of school. Then my father got a job at Williams College, later at Harvard. And then he returned to Washington as a member of the coordinator's office for Latin American affairs during the Second World War. He was never able to return, but any time there was a democratic or progressive government, he became the ambassador. And he was made ambassador at the end of the Second World War and was not in agreement with some of the pro-fascist or tendencies of the party to which he later joined and I joined and belonged to and was president of, by which evolved, but they exiled him. So that was the second time. And then at the end of his career, virtually, in 64, he was Victor Paz's de Soto's second government. He was a member, he was the ambassador in Washington, and there was a military coup and he was exiled for the third time. I now live in Washington as a political exile. I can't return, and I wouldn't dare return if I could. So the situation is such that it's a family tradition, and Chicago to be a political exile. I hope my daughter, my granddaughter, doesn't follow me in this footsteps. But the next and most important thing about this is that it's been a lifetime devoted to a struggle for democracy. When I returned to Bolivia after the experience of my father, I promised myself that I would never be a diplomat and never be a politician. I made films, I had a company that did a service company for the petroleum industry, and then I started a mining company, which later became the largest mining company in Bolivia. But you can't trust a politician and his promises even to himself. When democracy returned at the end of 20 years of military government, I accepted some advice from my father that it didn't make sense to be the richest man in such a poor country. And I went into public service because I think one of the big problems in Latin America is that you have to have a sense of responsibility. You cannot have power without responsibility. And although that's what politics love, you cannot have responsibility without power. And I think that that sort of sums up why I became a member of Congress and on two occasions elected to the Chamber of Deputies, then President of the Senate. I became a senator, all from Cochabamba, although I've been born in La Paz. My father's family was from Cochabamba. Finally, the Minister of Planning and Coordination when we stopped the hyperinflation. The shock therapy was almost 25,000%, and it was heading to a million. We might have beat Germany in the Guinness World Records, but unfortunately, it was very, very damaging to the social fabric, and we had to stop it, and we did. Later on, with that credibility, because I was the man who took the brunt of the hard measures that shock therapy mean, I developed credibility, which is the most valuable asset you can have in politics. I was declared persona non grata in all the departments of Bolivia except Pando, because I never visited. And in Cochabamba twice, because I was senator for Cochabamba, so they gave me very good attention. But the fact is that I developed a high level of credibility because what I told them was the truth and nothing but the truth. And I was seen as a reformer, as a modern person. And people felt, as I had a lot of money when I went into politics, I was going to be honest. led to the three victories in the campaigns. I won the presidency three times. The first time, there was skullduggery in the electoral court, so I was not able to, because when the election was finished, I won by very little, 1% against General Bouncer. But at that time, the three top people could be elected in the second round in the Congress, but they didn't receive the 51% majority. And when that happened, I was so pleased to have won that I wasn't very upset. I went the next time, won by a landslide. And this time it was pretty tough because the American ambassador was the campaign manager for Evo Morales. He kept attacking him and kept growing. So that's just a little bit why I got into politics, why I lived here as a woman. And I never complain about it, and you'll see in my letter of resignation that I was very pleased to serve my country. I still am. I wanted to retire, but I now have a trial for genocide, and I've had to sell my mining company, and I'm still the leader. So I'm still involved in living politics, and I hope to stay involved, although I don't think you see me as making a comeback at this point in life. The other problem that I would like to talk about very concisely is what I believe in. I'm considered a neoliberal. That's the big accusation. And the truth is I'm a neo-Thomist. I'm not neoliberal. I think that the orthodoxy of belief in the free market system is one of the big problems that has created some of the situations we live in. But I want to point out what I do believe in. It's a five-point step. First of all, I believe that a country or a society must be beholden to a new paradigm, which is equity, social equity. And I won't say social, I'll just say equity, like maybe the French, liberty, equity, solidarity. But I believe in equity. I remember as children, we were always worried about the fact that all the children had the same amount of charity. We didn't mind not having many, but we just didn't want anybody else to have more. It's the relativity of social sciences. And I think that this thing has to start out like a hand with a thumb, and that's economic growth. All elections are basically about three things: jobs, corruption, and I feel personal security. But of them all, as the Bible would say, the most important is jobs, economic growth. If you don't have a locomotive, you can't pull the train. You must have a way to generate the wealth that can change the quality of people's lives. And I think that there's nothing that can do that better than the market. I'll talk about it. I don't think that you can have an unregulated market. I think, like all competitive activities, and I don't know why it's so hard to understand. Maybe I got something wrong, but it's like sports. You can't have sports if you don't have rules and if you don't have impartial umpires and capable umpires. So I believe in the market economy. I think it's the only way you can generate wealth, especially in a democracy. And I'll explain that a little later. Secondly, I think, that's the second figure, I really believe that a society must be democratic, participative, and it must be decentralized. I think that, like a tree, you can only have a big tree if it has deep roots. And the roots have to be really in the ground. They must be well placed. These very powerful central governments that are not really embedded in the reality of their societies are very dangerous. I do not believe in federalism. I think that federalism and economies like Spain, I know why they happen. If the French don't scuttle the European Union in the next, I think it's really to pity the fact that the fact is that countries like the European Union will be a better union. You can't change so many years of history, of culture, of ethnic identity. And the United States, take a look at it, you couldn't do anything. It was a religious, fundamentalist society, and the American system had to be a system that was federal. That's why you have two senators for the big states, the little states, and the chamber of the House of Representatives is a house that is for population. I think that, I really believe that what has made this country, many countries, a strong local government, the greatness of this country and many societies, is, as Bolivian poor understand it, because that's when I used to go out and campaign, they would really understand it when I'd say, though educated people can become rich, not rich people educated. They understood that really the secret of getting out of poverty and doing anything is health and is education. But I think that that only works if it is run by local communities. If the communal government, and we did a measure when my government's called, in the first government, called popular participation, where we merged the cities into the counties, because the cities are really medieval creation. They were usually walled cities. And we made it so that they could really respond to the environmental and urban challenges of the modern world. And it was to give them great strength that we took these steps. But I think it has to be decentralized. And why does it have to be democratic? I think it has to be democratic because the decisions that really are important for people and the people are the decisions in local government. So the local government must be very participative, hopefully like town halls with a great deal, and the national government has to be very representative, because that's one place where you can't be running things from the streets or running things in town hall meetings. And I think that this, why should it be democratic? I think that if you combine a market economy that takes a lot of the brunt of political decisions away from the politicians, it can work. Many times people are surprised when I defend the market economy outside of other reasons, like economists would say, assignment of values. But in a market economy, can you imagine if the president of one of our countries or the United States could decide whether it would rain or it would shine on the weekend? He wouldn't win election again, because every weekend he'd take a decision that the farmers would hate or that the city dwellers would hate. So I really feel that the wonderful thing about a market is you can blame dark forces, bankers, mining, petroleum companies, multilateral, multinational, and you can let things operate. But obviously you can't have a democracy if you have to take the brunt of the responsibility of the corruption that takes place in state-run companies, and if you have to take the responsibility of the economic decisions. Governments in Bolivia used to fall when they moved the price of the currency. They would hold it off until it was a mega adjustment. And today in Bolivia, you can't move the price of hydrocarbons. And unless you get those tied, the cost politically is so great that you cannot survive without a democracy and a market economy. They both need each other. And obviously it has to be participative at the local level. It has to be decentralized. It has to be very strong, but it won't be strong if you don't have strong local government. The third thing, an economy, a society has to be redistributed. And as I said, it's health and education. If you can find a way to give these services through local government, because those are the things that most affect their lives, and I mean health and education a little bit bigger. I mean nutrition, and in education I mean sports and culture. I mean a bigger thing, because those are the things that affect people's lives and are really important to them. And I think that that is vital, and it has to be redistributed, especially in societies where we have this big gulf between the upper 20% in Bolivia must have 50 times more income than the lower, and even the rich aren't very rich in Bolivia. So I just want to say that this is a critical thing, that it be redistributed in the thing that the people want. They want their education and jobs, health is education, and these redistributive elements are the elements that can make us firm and solid society. The other thing that I think it has to be is racism. It has to be a system of law. There has to be the rule of law, and that wonderful concept of the 18th and 19th century that nobody is above the law is a concept that I still think, in a really old-fashioned fashion, will all forgive me, is a very important concept, that no man is above the law. And that wonderful concept of no servitude is acceptable except the servitude to the law. And I think that this makes a regulated society, because below that you have to have the empires and you have to have the rules so that the different economic and social sectors function. You know, we created, and I think in my government, my first government, we created a system of regulation for superintendents in the social, economic, and political sphere that I think was relatively successful. It was so simple that you had people, one superintendent, not these committees, because that's the way you get lack of justice and lack of regulation. Because if the responsibility belongs to one, you can't pass it off to a committee. So I think that it has to be regulated, it has to be a rule-driven society, and finally, it has to be a society that is conscious of the environment. And this is the part where the Coastal District examines that I was very attached to environmental sustainable development, because all of the things I've talked about is part of sustainable development. But I remember when I went to visit in the work goal in Bolivia and the Tijuana area, a landslide, because the miners had been deforested and had been working, a landslide that covered and killed many people. One of the people from the community came to me and said, that's a phrase I'll never forget. And he said to me, you know, man, pardon sometime. God always, but nature never. And I think that this is a humility that is very strong. It's not that and we created the old Stalinist type of control, command economy, Ministry of Planning and Coordination that I ran became the Ministry of Sustainable Development. Because I don't think you can have development as an NGO in the government like they have here in so many places. It has to be the driver, because really, God forgives all this man sometimes, but nature never. And I think that a lot of the problem of poverty that we face in Bolivia and the third world is created by problems of land degradation due to mistaken forms of development, even of irrigation, and two big dangerous things that were brought by Europe in the conquest. There were two things that really destroyed this wonderful paradise lost, which is the New World. And one was disease. It's hard to believe, and we were talking to a great historian from here called Neil, who wrote this book that I recommend to all these peoples and plagues. He couldn't believe a bunch of Spanish could take over the Inca Empire and the Aztec Empire, but they had great allies. In 50 years after the discovery, Americans estimated 90% of the indigenous population died. And in the chronicles of the Noche Triste in Mexico, where the Aztec warriors were dropping dead from smallpox and measles while they were struggling, and the chronicles of going down the rivers, the first Spanish explorers, conquistadores, found the Amazon was full of people, and they found that they were provided with food, with women, with great, and then they came back and there was nobody there. And the few people who were there had disappeared when they saw them coming. So I think the biggest problem was that, and the other big problem were, believe it or not, sheep and goats. If I could go back to Bolivia, the first thing I'd do is kill all the sheep and kill all the goats. grounds. Because they rip out the grass, they destroy the critical areas where there are humans, which do not have, they're very fragile. Well, it is a wonderful place because it has so many ecological floors and such a variety of parks and still primeval forests, the hardwood forests and birds. In one park in Bolivia, more birds than all of North America. And this is true, but at the same time, it's very fragile, and it cannot support anything that is not very environmentally fixed. And the people are losing that deforestation, overgrazing, desertification, and everything else that is taking place. Now, I'm sorry to have taken that time, but many people, I'm always attacked as being the Washington consensus, neoliberal. I was never that. I never knew enough about economy. I was appointed the czar of economic and social matters because I graduated in Chicago. But they didn't know I just got a BA, and I had no idea of economics, but I had been a successful businessman, so they figured I could stop a hyperinflation. But I learned one thing, and I want to tell all the economists here. And the problems are big in the economy. They're very easy to solve. It's the fine tuning that is dead. And almost all economic problems are born out of political situations. And that is the problem today. And now I would like to go, after this long presentation, into the text. First of all, I'm not going to talk about the future of Latin America because you cannot predict the future. And as Asian politician said, you can't predict the future, you can only invent it. I was one of the inventors. I now am sort of a kibitzer. I'm on the sideline. So, but I can give some scenarios, and I can give some preoccupations. We are facing the rise of populism, a very radical type of populism. Hard to explain, very bitter, very disappointed. It's born out of, ironically, some of the progress we've done. I remember how people used to be upset when the civil rights movement achieved so much in the United States, but they couldn't believe why people would burn the ghettos and people shot their leaders and all the rest. And until today, you see the difference between Latin American or immigration and the African Americans, who still have a great bitterness, and rightfully so because of the marginalization. And I think that this problem has always been there. It's coming forward because they haven't seen the results that I have tried so hard to do. And I think there are many explanations for what's happening, but it is a rise of a very authoritarian, very radical, very destructive type of populism. You just don't go out and throwing coins to the peasants. I mean, this is really very difficult, very complex. And the death of democracy, as we understand it, the rule of law, of representative government, and I think that is a very important movement that we have to take into account. The second Bush government, I am convinced, will ignore Latin America. But I don't know if they will be able to. That's their plan, is to ignore them. I came up and talked personally to President Bush about what was going to happen to me and how they had to become involved. And we had an opportunity that was really incredible. A process called privatization by some people, but truthfully capitalization. I realized that even the English and other European and North Americans prefer state-owned companies because they feel it belongs to them. They're very distrustful of these for-profit entities that don't take into account stakeholders. And I felt we had to make it into a type of privatization that came from the contribution of money and technology and management to the company. So we never sold anything. We did bidding processes where people invested in our companies. And we were extremely successful. In 5 years, we went from 5 trillion cubic feet of gas to 60 trillion cubic feet of gas with a potential of between, it is estimated, between 3 and 500 trillion cubic feet. The wealth of Bolivia once again has come back to convince, like it did in the rubber boom, where Brazil created a state, an independent republic called La República del Acre, and then when the war was over with Bolivia, they became two states of Brazil. Like the War of the Pacific, where we lost our seacoast. Chile didn't need a seacoast, they got the biggest one in the world, but it goes all the way to Antarctica. But the problem is that that piece of real estate was so rich in guano, in nitrates, in copper, in minerals, that it was irresistible. And today, the same thing is possibly going to happen today, because we have a reserve that is desperately needed by Brazil, by Argentina, and by Chile, and even by Peru. And I think that the separatist movement, which is basically based on the fact that a small pressure group, an elite in the Santa Cruz region, wants to hold on to their land, to their forestry concessions, things like the sustainable development forestry concessions that you have to renew every 5 years, because we did a new land reform where you have to do land with certain responsibility for how you grow it and how you take care of it, not just cut down the trees and work it. I feel that they are very worried that they're going to lose with this new currency of populism. They're going to lose, and they're obviously going to be very much helped by our neighbors. It's called the Media Luna. Where the gas is at the base of the Andes, and runs from the Argentine border all along the Andes into Peru. There's only four fields found, of which two of them have very important contents of liquid hydrogen. Two of them are only gas. But you have 60 trillion cubic feet in four fields. They're called elephants. I came to the United States saying, you have to help me export this stuff through the Pacific, because we can solve our balance of payments, we can solve our fiscal deficit. We were running at an incredible, almost American level of deficit. And and they said to me, you know, we can buy our gas and hydrocarbons at any place, so that's your problem, not our problem. When I go back to tell them why they said that to me, they said, well, it wasn't $50. But the problem is that it is vital for us, because Brazil, even though it talks about the important discoveries it's made, 14 trillion, this potential is very deep water. You need technology like in the North Sea. It's very critical, and you've seen that Petrobras has lost an important drill. Argentina, they need Bolivian gas. They need it now. It's much cheaper. They also, Argentina is with maturing fields, again like the North Sea. Oil fields get to a point, then they start to mature, and of course if the prices are right, but in Argentina they've been held down, so the consumption is exploding. And Chile is making investments, is talking about trying to negotiate to bring it from Australia, and although sea transport is free, but bring liquid gas from Australia, because they don't trust the stability in Indonesia. You can understand how critical this is, and I don't think our neighbors, once again, the curse of wealth, which never got to the people and was never turned into health and education. And I think when you look at the wealthy countries, you look at England and the United States, you look at Japan, they're mostly countries that were not blessed with great natural resources. And we also have a political dynamic that's very important. And that is, in the plan of things, the United States felt that there would be an axis of good, which would be Chile, Bolivia, and Colombia. But now they've found that one of the links is now being run by our friend Chavez. And the Venezuelans, somebody said, what's Venezuela like? Well, it's like Texas, but with lots of money. And the problem is that this is an authoritarian type of government, a man who really believes he is the reincarnation of Simón Bolívar. And it is upon him to unite all of South America as Bolívar wanted to in one great nation. And he feels that that's his role. And he's got $50 oil, and he has controls of three powers. There's no checks and balances. And he's going to be a very important player. But the other big player in Latin America creating great instability is drugs. Now, I hope this is off the record. I know there's a reporter who's kind enough to identify himself to me. But it's very hard for a person who comes from a drug-producing country to comment, as I have commented many times in personal meetings with presidents and ministers and ambassadors, the American drug policy is absolutely dead. As a good Roman Catholic waiting for the new Pope to be elected, I have the blessing of being able to ask for forgiveness a few minutes before I die, and I'll go to heaven. Thank you. Now, the problem is that you cannot prohibit vice. The U.S. prohibition was deadly. The people who did it, they changed the Constitution. It's not easy in this country. 10 years later, those same people had to change it. The mayor, the vice mayors, the judges were all controlled by the mafia of illegal alcohol. You cannot prohibit vice. You can educate it out of it, like you're trying to do in tobacco. You can tax it. You can do a lot of things, but you can't change it. And I think that this has led to a dynamic where Evo Morales, for instance, is a well-known element in the Bolivian scene, and other players are being financed by the tax on coca. They're not in the drug-producing business, but in the colony there was three taxes, one on land that the Indian communities produced, one on coca because they used coca for the mines and the haciendas, and finally the tax on mines, which was 20% because, of course, according to the Inca style, the communities had to give the miners. So the situation is that tax is being collected. He has all the money in the world, but the recognition, the instructions, that he needs is coming from the axis of Venezuela and Cuba. And I think that this is not to say you can only do it, but the big driving force between it is the drug business. In a seminar, an open seminar that was held on terrorism in Bogota, the security authorities of Colombia said that there were 70 people in the riots, 70 people from FARC in the riots that overthrew them. The other big current is the current of fundamentalism, of not of a religious nature, but an ideological really sendero of Michael Felipe Quispe, who's a leader and a very influential people, a person when the trouble starts, he's not very influential except when there isn't trouble. He is a person who reflects, he was in jail for blowing out power lines and all the rest. He reflects a very violent, almost anarchist, Maoist kind of definition, which I have never been able to understand. And I hope some brilliant scholars at the University of Chicago will do a few doctors degrees so I can understand what they're proposing. But it's pretty violent. And I also think he has one redeeming factor. He has a good sense of humor. He said, when we separate the island nation and become our own country, we will have a ministry for white affairs. Caucasian. So I think there are things that you can smile about, but the dynamic, ideologically, the dynamic of drugs is an explosive combination for what I call the rise of populism and the death of reason and the fall of reason. It's a time when it's faith-driven, it's ideological, it's carried by, you can't win the battle. You can't win the argument. It's almost like arguing with your wife. There's no logic that they would listen to. And the other side of the coin, no way that you can really present to them something that is so foreign. They don't believe that democracy takes them into account. They don't understand that equity is one man, one vote, but we have to work to get the women to vote, so that you can't prohibit them to take transport. But you have to improve it. That democracy is something you continually improve, but it's a system of participation of local government should be very ingrained in the people and high to finance. In popular participation, we transfer responsibilities, but we also transfer 20% of the funds in one method of distribution, which is you've got the same amount whoever you were and whatever you were. So it was really a population-based transfer of funds, and only set up funds to help the people who lived in greater poverty or have greater difficulties in education. Now, once again, I think that you have a scenario that is very worrisome because of the dynamics of these currents and the fact that they are overshadowing the true things that we've been struggling for, which is an equitable society. I really worry about it, and I really hope for the better, but I think that we have to learn and say we have to be ready for the worst and hoping for the best. And I think that we have to hope that there will be young, motivated people who will play a definitive game. I'm still in the game, but I'm on the bench, and I'm not the player I was 25 years ago. But the system is that we have to invent our future. We have to find a way to synthesize this growing strength, looking for participation, radical in its demands, and very, very frustrated. We cannot continue to pander to the fears and the frustrations of people who must speak the truth and tell them what will happen and not just say, you know, if you don't do this, it's going to go badly. If you don't do this, it's going to go okay. There has to be a tradition of a new model, and I think it's basically social equity. As I said, we're ready for the worst, but we're hoping for the best. Thank you very much.
Much, and actually you hit the mark. That was wonderful. It's something that you say academics can be brief, and I beg to differ. You have to ramble on for hours. But now it's the opportunity for an open debate, a discussion, a series of questions, and Mr. Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, comments. We'll take questions and comments in either Spanish or English, but the reply will be in English for those of you here who speak exclusively English, perhaps the best approach. The floor is now open for questions, comments. Yes.
Okay. My name is Oswaldo Pereira. I'm a Aymara descendant. I'm born in Yunguyo, born in Peru and Bolivia, so I have dual nationality. Well, I want to thank for having plant the roots for people, Aymara people, empower them to be able to kind of lead their destiny by their own. Thank you for that. I think Bolivia has a great future, although right now we're going into very much troubles because we have this ideology of the whites and the Indians, which I am, and somehow one of these like civil rights that you said, and eventually we'll level it out. And I just want to say thank you to him, through his government. I've seen a lot of progress, especially in the Bolivian side. And although in Peru we had a shining pride and all those other things that somehow had equalized a little bit the empowerment of the indigenous people, which is my people. And hopefully that can go to that route, like the shining pride. I have some of my family is from Bolivia, some of my family is from Peru. So I thank you very much for your contribution to the empowerment.
Just a small comment. There's no doubt that if there's anything that's lost its boundaries, made by by colonial powers. As you know, Bolivia was an Alto Peru, and it was part of the Viceroy of Lima, the Virreinato of Lima. And then, when the Bourbons took power in Spain, they made Bolivia part of the Virreinato de la Plata. And it's really because of its great wealth and its strong institutions, because I'd say it's a country cursed, it's a poor country cursed by wealth. And the problem was that when they, today with Peru, we have a big, big problem because the late Titicaca split right down the middle. And the Aymara people, who are a very strong and very important ethnic group, who have defined the personality of my country in a great deal, they are in Peru in the northern part of Chile. And it's just like the Kurds who are divided up, and you know. And I think that it's important, and we, as you rightfully point out, my vice president was the first man from the country, the Aymara from Titicaca, was Victor Hugo Cárdenas, who was Choquehuanca, but he changed his name so he could go to schools and became a great educator. We did educational reform with Victor Hugo. One of the big problems is to hope that some of these tendencies permit the integration of ethnic groups and countries. I really believe diversity, union and diversity. I really feel that you have to be diverse. And it was part of the step we took away from the Mexican Revolution in my party, where we felt that the clash of indigenous ethnic groups with European groups should lead to the new man of the new world. And I don't believe that. I think we should try to have people who have the same opportunities, people who are not suffering that, but who are able to live under diversity and unity. I think that one of the roles would be that role. Now, Victor Hugo Cárdenas is considered an uncle Tom. He was a wonderful, loyal, really, he talked to me things I could have never known because I wasn't even living there. And he was the guiding hand for popular participation, educational reform. I'm very proud to have had him and to have picked him. And I think it's a hopeful thing that they participate in government, but I hope that the ideas, the radical ideas of anti-globalization, anti-democracy, and all the things that we're looking at today will be put to one side so we can have unity in diversity, not just in Bolivia, but in regions and in areas.
Yes. I have a sort of an opinion question. With the talks going on now in Bolivia about the autonomias, the regional autonomies for Santa Cruz, for Tarija, for the other departments, and the timing between that and the Constituent Assembly, which is also, I think, problematic in terms of which departments are going to go, in what numbers, I'd like to ask your opinion about that, because you stated previously that you're opposed to federalism, but could more regional autonomy to these departments be a solution or a problem? How do you see that resolving itself? Because it's at the crossroads right now. Your opinion.
Well, Bolivia has always had a dynamic between a unitarian government and federalist government. The Civil War at the end of the 19th century between Sucre and La Paz was really related to the end of the period of silver and the beginning of the mining in the coastal in the region of the Altiplano. Tin, tungsten, and antimony. And it was a war done because the Paseños wanted to have, it was a civil war, they wanted to have federalism. They took it to a vote. They lost by one vote. Because now they have the capital, why should they have a federal system? And I always used to tell Bolivians, why do you want 9 bad governments and have an awful government? And it's a real problem. First of all, you can't afford it. It's very difficult to afford it. I can understand the deep causes, like in the European Union or the United States, but I can also understand the great cost. The great cost of federalism was seen by the American Civil War. You know, the big problem there was by the states' rights It had to be solved belongs to me and Dad. Tremendous dislocation, which was never entirely solved because emancipation took place, but they never achieved the goal of the civil rights or the equality that was promised and was committed in the Constitution of the United States. All people are created equal. Again, equality. So I think that what we look at here is that governments that are closer to the people are more legitimate. The national government is the less legitimate, the regional is more, and the local is the most. And I think you should fight against that. Not because you wanna, and that's why I did popular participation. Today in Bolivia, this thing of autonomy is just so they can say we wanna be autonomous, and then it's a separation. It's like the Basque. They have to, for everything that they can, now they want to be in Europe, that's becoming a federal nation. They want to be an independent country. Well, I guess if you're Basque, you can go ahead and do it, but I don't think you can do it if you're in Bolivia, unless you have an awful lot of natural gas and neighbors who want to buy a bridge.
Yes.
Mr. Gonzalo Sanchez de Rosada, first I'd like to say it's a pleasure to meet you. I had an opportunity to see you in Banco in 2003. I've actually been studying decentralization in Santa Cruz, and I'm a little bit worried by the movement of Mr. Ocama and Kinesek of Santa Cruz. And now with the resignation of the prefecto, Carlos Hugo, do you see that with the resignation of the prefecto, the movement to directly elect prefectos, that there will be a recentralization to the departmental level?
Yeah. I think the big problem we found is that the people disliked the regional administration because, of course, it was the prefecture, it was the plan. And in the decentralization law, we tried to create a double legitimacy. A democratically elected president would appoint a prefecture, and all the local governments, the councilmen of the local governments would elect the council that would govern with that prefect. And the prefect wouldn't be a separation of powers. He would be the commission where he presided over, but it had social control and responded to. It was an effort to try, and it headed off for at least a long time. It stopped this movement. The movement in Santa Cruz has deep roots, because Santa Cruz and all the tropical part of Bolivia felt really marginalized, and they were very frustrated. And they fought very hard to get railroads down. Because before, with the age of railroads, you had mule trains on Santa Cruz, and all that region was very well integrated into the Altiplano. The sugar came from Santa Cruz to the mines in Potosí, because they were moving on a type of infrastructure. But the day you needed railroads or you needed roads, they became completely marginalized and backward. So they have a deep disappointment ingrained in them that they have not been attended to, although almost 40% of national investment goes to this part of the nation. That may be part of the problem. We didn't invest. We took it out of the highlands and sent it down there, and they're not even grateful, because anything you get for free, you never received. But I think it's a very, very dangerous item. My support, mine and my party, was in the Media Luna, Half Moon. And I'm very, very grateful, and I really see them as the California and Bolivia, and they're really believing in change and improvement. But I also see it as a way to get out of the collapse of expectations and the frustration and anger that probably is justifiable. And I don't really understand it, because I spend too much time playing games, Nintendo games and the politics of Bolivia, and I lost the contact with the people, which I had achieved when I used to visit them and try to get their vote. But at the point of reality that we live in today, I think it's the most dangerous, and I think it will start as an election. How can you have an election on pretext when the president's supposed to name it? Only Carlos Mesa, pardon me, could say, well, you elect him and I'll appoint him. this is something new. They knew they couldn't get it with me, so they had to get out, because that's not what the Constitution says. But I really think it's the beginning of the separation of Bolivia. And I hope that we will find the one thing that's optimistic in Bolivia in all of these areas, except, let's say, in places like Colombia, is that we don't have violence. We have some brew, we got over it. In Bolivia, they still block roads, it's a very difficult situation, but it's still not organized or really it's functioning. And I hope, while there's still dialogue, we have a chance to find, we always like to go up to the edge. It's brinksmanship of the worst nature, and I hope we'll pull it off, that we'll find some type of national unity in that context.
Yes.
Hi. One of the points you made was about building a new paradigm of social equity. And you said that one of the ways of accomplishing this, maybe the only way, is through economic growth. Nevertheless, there are a lot of other examples of countries in the Southern Cone that have achieved economic growth, but at the same time have not had the growth of social equity. You think of Argentina, which is included in the last decade. And I think it occurs to me that this might have something to do with the relationship between the local government and the state. And you spoke about the importance of having a more participatory local government. And I'm curious as to what you think the relationship is, or should be, how to craft a relationship between the state and local governments so that through economic growth, greater social equity can be brought about.
Well, as you know, one of the most important reforms I did was popular participation and decentralization, administrative decentralization. There were two different laws. And in popular participation, I achieved the universality of corruption. Now they steal all of this money. And before we just told to be central government. I didn't steal because I went into government with a lot of money. But I wasn't able to do what a government has to do to make sure the others don't pulse. It's not enough to be honest yourself. You have to take care of other people who are part of your administration. And coalition politics can be rapidly become very corrupt to be able to get the type of votes and the type of requirements that you need. Now, when you come back to this, we tried to do in popular participation, create oversight committees. The communities would elect representative from every community who would be an oversight committee and would control the accidental municipal government, which was given jurisdiction, which were the secciones of police, what we call the counties, and we made them one thing, municipal government, so that there would be a rural and urban dynamic. Now, the big problem there is that we weren't able to consolidate that. We really had to cut the umbilical cord, get them the money. We kept the central government paying for health workers and teachers, and the truth is that you had unions that were fighting this, and they weren't willing to accept it. In a relatively small town close to La Paz, the people would come in on Tuesday. They would work Tuesday afternoon, all Wednesday, Thursday morning, and go home to La Paz, the teachers. And the community would complain to me, and when they went hiking in those areas, it's very difficult because they really had a dynamic. They were protected by unions, they had tenure, they had a series of things that we never were able to achieve the hire or fire rule, which is true authority in any sort of government activity, with the respect and protection of civil service, which is also a requirement, no doubt. But I think the problem is that nobody wants to submit to the community and understand that they are serving the community. And this is an area, an unachieved agenda, which has now become much more difficult to achieve because there's disappointment, there's frustration, there's fear, and that leads to a frustration, which I hope will not be forever, but which right now is very, very strong, and where these important measures can be reversed. I really believe, and if you look at the United States, you look at Sweden, you look at Denmark, these were all very poor countries. Sweden, around the turn of the 19th, at the end of the 19th century, lost 40% of its population. They were very starving. And they finally, why did they change? Because they had in their poverty a system of local education. The United States had one-room schoolhouses. And the situation that has to be accompanied is a dynamic which we have to find a way that it is embedded, it has roots in the community that's very strong. But it makes the government, local government very participative, and national government very representative. Now we have national government that is decided in the streets by blocking the roads and rioting and burning the buildings. That's not exactly what we want for state society. But we've got it all the way around.
Hi, I want to just welcome you back to university. I'm originally from Cochabamba, so I've been raised in New York, but my family, I have extensive family there. So my question is, I know that governments in Latin America face extreme pressure to liberalize and market and implement market policies. And since you say that these market economies are the way to generate wealth to change people's lives, then why is there such great opposition to these policies in governments in Latin America, especially in Bolivia? Why do leaders like Luis Epifanio Morales, why are they able to gather such massive people to back them in programs of nationalization and push policies to sort of do away with neoliberal policies? How can we begin to understand this opposition to neoliberal policies from your perspective?
Well, I think the problem is, one, you can't expect people to be happy if you don't produce results. But the results take a while. Machiavelli said, I don't recommend that the prince install change. Because those affected realize it immediately, and those benefited take a long time. And I think, and we've had a conversation, that one of the great problems was that if I had been able to stand for elections, re-election, I would have had the time between the 5 years and the 4 years, in 9 years to be because it's like fruit trees. In the third year, they start producing fruit, and then the fourth year gets bigger, and it enters into pure production in the fifth year. And I think that part of the problem is that, and the other problem is it's a struggle for power. When I was doing educational reform in Bolivia was basically that everybody had to be taught read and write and arithmetic in their native language. If the structure of learning, and I've seen it here when I see this argument about bilingual education, we weren't talking about bilingual education. With Victor Hugo Cardenas, we were talking about reading and writing and arithmetic in their native language, even if they spoke Spanish, so Spanish, but in their mother tongue. The language the mother speaks. The minute your mind is formed, these people go to school to become Spanish-speaking, not to preserve. I'm lucky, I'm a romantic, my father was a romantic, we believe in the Aymaras, the Quechuas. You know, he got a stroke in the last, we could only communicate through the mate because he could only remember Quechua. And it was because he had been brought up in a time when we had wet nurses, and that was the first language he learned. But the problem is that they really want to be part of the world. And the same thing, people immigrate here want to be part of the world. But they'll never learn it if they don't go in the first years of school and learn how to read and write Spanish. Then they'll shift to Sanskrit, Mandarin, English, Polish, anything you want them to learn. Because children are like that, like ducks to water. So I think the problem that we have in this context is that when we were offering this to people, they would come and say, but you're going to privatize the education. And I say, I'm not going to privatize the education. We're going to change it in this manner. We're going to do it in this form so you're going to achieve what you're looking for. And I remember I used to have town hall meetings on TV and talk this over. And we had a person from the community close to Tiwanaku who came to this town hall, and he said to me, you know, I'm really worried about this educational reform because I've been told it's going to be privatization. So I explained it in more detail than I have to you. And then finally he asked for the word again, and he said it in Aymara. And Victor Hugo Cardenas, who's an Aymara and an educator, explained it to us. And when it all finished, we were having, you know, invited soft drinks and some beer and stuff afterwards. And the people who had been at this town hall meeting, this televised town hall meeting, and he came up to me and said, I'm so pleased. I couldn't imagine I would be in the palace together with you, and I will never forget this. But I can't be in agreement with your educational reform. Why? I said, he explained it fine. He said, because you're going to privatize. The problem is when you have people with a slogan that appeals to their fears, their well-founded fears, they've never been spoken to honestly, their well-founded fears and their well-founded frustrations, then all you have to do is say they're going to privatize, and it's the end. There's no way you can liberate. And when you go, and when I went around saying to them, the gas will be exported, and it will, the condition for the export will be to bring gas to people's houses and all the public service vehicles, so that you will now bring down your cost of energy to 50%. In the outcome, you could have heating, you could have hot water, you could have cooking at 50% of what it costs today for poor people. And secondly, all the profits, the taxes on profits and the taxes on excess profits, which you get when you have mega fields of hydrocarbons, those will be put in a fund run by United Nations or run by representatives elected by two-thirds of Congress or the different ethnic groups. Whatever you want to do, that'll be run for health and education. Everybody was in agreement, but then somebody come along and said, they're going to take it out, they're going to rip it out. Our poverty is because they're taking it out, they're not taking anything out. And I remember once in the mining industry, I went to a community that didn't want, you know, we found a mine, we wanted to work it. Long ago, far away. And I said, why don't you want to work it? Because if you work it, we won't have anything for our grandchildren and our children. But if you don't work it, what are you going to have? So it's a very difficult dynamic, and if it's being handled, opinions that are very justified. I'm not saying these are, they're very justified because we've had hundreds of years that they've been lied to. They've seen great booms, great wealth, and nothing has remained except for marginalization and discrimination.
In your talk, you barely mentioned the military of Latin America at all, and I think that's wonderful. It's a sign that we're in much better times. And yet, if there is risk of greater civil conflict, I assume that that means that police forces and armies, by their actions and by their inaction, potentially could become more powerful, or they may get new kinds of appeals from all sides. Could you say something about what you anticipate might be the challenges facing the military?
Contrary to most democratic governments, and believe this history, I would never looking over my shoulder at the military. The situation was so dire when democracy started, the economic situation. No army wants to occupy a ravaged land, hyperinflation that destroyed it. And so I must say that in all the time I always counted on, they were very constitutional. The most important thing, the high command, none of them had been in the coup. And if you hadn't been in the coup, it isn't easy to do it. I mean, if you read the coup that they tried to organize against Hitler, the Germans couldn't do it because they didn't know how to do a coup. And you got to know how to do it. You usually learn it by being a captain or a lieutenant when the generals are out taking over the government. And this hasn't happened. The whole high command I had, none of them had been in the coup. Two, they know that they're going to be sidelined because there is a strong and well-consolidated consensus that it can't work. Even Chavez, when he was overthrown by the military, was protected by everybody, so he came back. But he's not by the paradigm of democracy. But I think that the situation that we have is, I'm very scared if they get involved that they will lose the battle. And you can have some very difficult situations. And I was very careful. I had the choice of going to Santa Cruz and saying, okay, here we're going to move the Congress here, it's all over. And we're going to block El Paso, so nobody can get in and out. That was what you had to do. I was just very scared that you would set off a dynamic, that you would split the armed forces. I like to finish, although all my life I lived here because we were thrown out and exiled by military governments. We were dying with little Democrats, and still am. But by authoritarian governments, let's say, or military governments. But let's go back to what I really think. When I give the shock therapy and we stop the hyperinflation, I had a big problem because the Cubanos kept helping the armed forces. Of course, they were earning $10 or $100 or $200. This hyperinflation wiped out all their salaries. But he kept it, and I said, I can't hold stability if you keep benefiting the armed forces. And he said, you're a great troop. And he had been thrown out by a military coup, and he had destroyed the armed forces to take over the 52 revolution. He said to me, dying, when we fail, the only thing left is the armed forces. I'm afraid that over these 25 years of democracy, the longest period in Bolivia's history, that we have not been able to transform it into an institution that can be effective, that understands the people, and I think we will be playing the fire. I think we'll probably get peacekeeping people before, and I hope the army doesn't get involved. It's going to get, there's too much money in drugs and around the world to think that they can really resist like they did traditionally with the repression and genocide, the uprisings. People are going to be better trained and better armed than they are. That's going to be the problem with Colombia.
I think we will have time for one or possibly two more questions before we go to the reception, after which you're all cordially invited. I see a question back here.
Thank you. Time to say. So why did you meet me? I've been working in Bolivia for the past 20 years as Catholic religious missionary in the southern part of Bolivia. And I want to ask you tonight, I've heard some undercurrents in terms of the present government and perhaps suggesting a lack of control. And also I've heard about the populist movement of Evo Morales as perhaps being a little revolutionary or a little, revolutionary, I'll say. What would you propose? What would be your advice to our president, Carlos Mesa, now in terms of what could be done about this situation? How can we listen to the demands of the people that Evo Morales represents, as well as to the rest of the population? And the second question I have is a little more painful, a little more delicate. You said that no man is above the law. Does this mean that you are thinking of returning to Bolivia to face the accusations that have been brought against you?
No, obviously not, because that's a lynch mob. You know, in the terror of the French Revolution and in the cowboy films, you always have a trial before they hang you. So the last thing I'll do is go there, because it'll take a while before that happens, because you can either be kidnapped, killed, or imprisoned without due process of law. So don't worry, I'm not returning yet, but I might show up. But the problem is that what I would say, this is in a very tough situation, because he pulled back and was part of the conspiracy that got me out. And maybe if he had said, I'm not in agreement with the president, but here I resign, the Congress wouldn't have had time to take his resignation, he would have taken over. And I think that this is something that we have to accept. I recognized, and I wasn't making a big fuss about the vice president, but that happens all the time. As a matter of fact, I sent a message to Mr. Fuchs and trusted people. I said, look, I'm ready to retire. I want a golden watch, no trials. And you're judged by history, by how effective you are when you get to government, not by how you got there. So, but he's very tied up in a knot. He feels very bad about what he did, I guess, because he wants to put me on trial. And companion can't use force, because the minute you use force, he'll be together with me and I lost in an impeachment trial for genocide. I mean, to maintain law and order, and if one person dies, it's very serious for a president, because you're not there to kill anybody, but you do swear before God and the Constitution of the country to uphold the Constitution. And I think that the problem is that he has a very serious problem, because I don't think any government right now has the consensus, the moral authority, to use force. And a state without cohesion, I mean, if you use force, it would have to be at such a scale that would be simply scandalous, because people have accepted that everybody can go out manifestar tranquilamente, meaning blow up gas stations, they'll blow up all the bridges, block all the roads, leave the people, take people hostage. This is called peaceful manifestación. And I think that the problem is that there has to be a workout in a way, and that's why I hope that there won't be a higher level of violence. And in a way, by seeding and seeding, maybe he will achieve an acceptance, although we don't see it yet, that you just can't run a country like that. And they will accept again that that the people elect the government, but the government has to govern according to the Constitution. So I don't know what advice to give, but maybe I could give the advice, resign and join me in Washington.
one more question.
Or go to Talia.
We'll take one more question before going to the reception afterwards. Is there a question here? Yes.
On a totally different subject, in respect to shock therapy, what are the actual learnings from shock therapy, as we've seen it has been employed in Poland years after? What was also the input from Jeffrey Sachs in this respect?
Well, I think there's two things to say, that shock therapy is required because as the problem gets bigger, there's no way to solve it. When we know that we took 3 weeks to confess, I was the court of it. We had two lawyers, two economists, two businessmen, two ministers who did the U.S. citizen of the 2106. And we spent a week arguing whether it could be done gradually. And we spent another week saying whether we had to do anything. Better said, we started 1 week, and we did the calculations, we would have been 1,000,000% at the end of 12 months. So we finally learned that we had to do it. Victor Paz had to change everything he did, go from a candle, and the only way you can do it, and you have to do it with a shock, because what happens is the currency is undervalued, and the labor is very inexpensive. So if you don't bring in foreign, if you don't bring outside prices, you can never establish the price controls, interest controls, controls on rationing. All of these things were destroying the country, because it really takes a very good bureaucracy to run it. And when it gets out of control, like happens in a hyperinflation, it's been generally, and when does the moment come that it happens? And I think this is a problem of political economy. We found that at the beginning, inflation is very beneficial for the middle class and the upper middle class, and the upper classes and businessmen, because they can protect themselves. They can buy things, they can buy dollars, and usually the devaluation is faster than the rise of prices or salaries. But there comes a moment where the prices go faster than the currency, and then nobody's making money. Because, of course, the people who have their salaries destroyed, have their purchasing power destroyed, are the poorest people. And there comes a moment where nobody's the winner, and they all are willing to accept it. And that moment, it has to be one shot, because the antibodies develop, and you have to do it like we did. We had a 24-hour cabinet meeting, went over this decree that we had prepared, and Victor Paz at 78 sat up there for 24 hours. He wouldn't let anybody go to the phone. And I said, well, you know, why are you so worried? The inflation is so high. He said, I'm worried because if we let them go any place that isn't bathroom, they'll never come back. So I think the problem was, the problem is that you have to take these steps, because if you don't take radical steps, and as I said before, the secret of economics becomes, when it becomes really crisis, it becomes relatively simple, because the solution is political. And we were only able to stop it when we elected a new government. I would like to tell the last story. I went to a seminar between my first and my second government in Rotterdam, and up comes Don Stalensis, and he said, I wanted to meet you. I wanted to meet any Bolivian, because every time they made us do terrible things, they would say, you have to do it this way, because that's how it was done in Bolivia. And they would always mention your name. And I want to meet you and tell you how much you made the Polish people suffer. And I said, but thanks to shock therapy, you now have a pope.
Yeah, thank you very much.